All right, so today I want to do something that's by way of an introduction to the general stuff that we need to cover. And, well, one of the things I'm headed towards is a discussion of the local trace formula, actually the local trace formula for, I'll discuss more the case of the Lie algebra than the case of the group. But anyway, as a sort of way to get oriented in the subject, I want to explain what happens just on an abstract, compact Hausdorff topological group. All right. So this is sort of local. Well, I don't know, but local doesn't make much sense anymore because there's no local global. It's just some compact group. So maybe it's just the trace formula. Or a compact Hausdorff topological group, G. When you're on a compact group, it's the most natural Haar measure to take is the one that gives the group measure G, measure 1. Sorry, I'm a little fuzzy this morning. And I'll typically write something like BG, all right? But we want the Haar measure that gives G measure 1. And then when we do things like a convolution, it'll always be understood as this measure. If I form the L2 space on the group G, it'll be with this measure, et cetera. All right, so there it is. That's the L2 space on that group G. In the local trace formula, you actually look at L2 of G as a module over G, but it, in both ways. I mean, you can either left translate your functions by a group element, or you can right translate them. And those two things commute with each other, left translations and right translations, which means that really the group G cross G is acting on this L2 space. That's the G. So typically I'll write something like phi for an element in the L2 space. We'll have other functions on the group. The ones that are serving to, as elements in the group algebra that you convolve with, I'll usually write those as an f. But when I'm thinking about them as things in this L2 space, it's a module, I'll typically write the function as phi. So what's the action? Let's make it explicit. All right, so there's my phi, that's the function. And there's a pair of group elements. The one on the left will translate the functions on the left. All right, so this is now, again, a function. So that's a function of x. And my modules are going to be left modules. And to make it a left action on these functions, I need to make it g1 inverse x. G2. Okay, so now that is a legitimate left action of G cross G on these functions. As usual, we don't want to just consider translating functions by group elements. We also want a smeared out version of that. Just like on a finite group, you don't just use the group elements, you all use elements in the group algebra. So here, the group algebra that we want, there's, of course, various versions of it. But let's write C of G just for the continuous functions on this compact. I mean, if we had a locally compact group, I might want to take compactly supported, but the group's compact, so I don't have to worry about that. This is just continuous functions on G. And so this is a... this is an algebra under convolution. Where we use this measure DG to convolve those functions. Okay, so again, functions on G, but somehow playing a different role. So now, if we have two functions like this, we can smear out these two actions, left and right translation actions, using those functions, and get an action of that pair of functions on this L2 space. All right, so now suppose we have two functions, two continuous functions. Then I want to write a formula for the action of, well, probably the best way to write it is I could write it as a pair F1 comma F2, but basically we're dealing with a tensor product, so I'll just write it like this. But this is just the action of the two functions, F1 and F2, on, well, again, some function in the L2 space. Okay. Again, that's a function on the group, so X is a variable in the group. Well, how do these smeared out actions work? They always work the same way. In this case, we've got two functions, so I have to integrate over the group twice, one for each, one integrals for the first function, the other integrals for the second function. And we just smear out this action. So we have F1 of G, F2, oh, sorry, F1 of G1, F2 of G2. And now we have to plug in our action, which was written up there. So it's G1 inverse XG2. Well, and there's our Haar measure occurring twice. Well, now you can, I want to think of this thing as being given by, as an integral operator with a kernel function. Just like in the global trace formula, you want to think of your operator as being integration of the given function phi against another function, and then that function depends upon x. So it's the kernel function is only two variables, and the output is this function of x. Well, this is not in the right form to see that, because we have phi evaluated on this thing here. So we just want to change variables in such a way as to make this thing just be phi of a single variable. All right, so you have to change variables. And you'll see from the form of this what the change of variables was. Because you can see that I didn't do anything to the G1 that has survived unchanged, but the change of variables was to replace G2 by this expression. So it just changes to that. And then here, the G2 gets replaced by this expression, but this and this cancel out this and this. Sorry, oh, I didn't, yes. So this is missing. Thank you. Phi of G2. Well, now we see this as being an integral operator, because we do have, now it is phi being integrated against something. That thing is itself an integral. Okay, so this thing is an integral operator with kernel function. Of course, it depends on these functions, but I won't write that. I should probably write K sub F1 comma F2 or something, but let's not bother. So it's just whatever is left there without the phi. All right, now I did this for this combination operation where we're doing something on the left and on the right. We could also have just forgotten about F2 and just done something using F1 on the left action. And that also would have been, you know, you can do as an exercise, if we had just omitted this, the calculation would be very similar, and we would have found that just using F1 would also have been an integral operator. Same way if we had just used F2 by itself, that would have also been an integral operator with a certain kernel. Now these kernels are, this kernel here and the other ones that we would have gotten, although I won't write them, they're continuous functions on G cross G. G cross G is again compact, so these are L2 functions, and these are very good kernel functions. They're square integrable functions, and that means you're in the best case. So therefore K is a square integrable, L2. Therefore, this operator that we have, this integral operator, is a Hilbert-Schmidt operator, and the Hilbert-Schmidt norm is the L2 norm of this thing. So therefore, our operator is Hilbert-Schmidt. Again, that reasoning applies to the two individual things, just using F1 by itself or using F2 by itself. And the thing that we're actually using is the product of the two. So we're in a better situation yet. Namely, the actual operator we're using is the product of two Hilbert-Schmidt operators, and therefore is a trace class operator. And moreover, okay, so our operator, oh, no, I don't want to use this part. Okay, our operator is product of individual guys for F1, F2, both of which are Hilbert-Schmidt, both of which have L2 kernels, kernel functions, and hence are Hilbert-Schmidt again. And that means not only, actually if you, this is just very elementary things in operator theory on Hilbert spaces. It means just for very elementary reasons, basically the only thing you have to use is Fubini's theorem. If you look in how these things are proved, there's no deep analysis, it's just Fubini's theorem. This means that not only is the operator we have of trace class, the trace of it is simply the integral of the kernel over the diagonal. Remember, a kernel function is just a continuous analog of a matrix. The analog of taking the trace of that matrix is to integrate the thing on the diagonal. Those are the diagonal entries in the matrix, if you want to think about it as a continuous matrix. So therefore, a trace of this, well, I didn't give the operator really a name, so I guess I'll just do it this way. The trace of this operator that we get from F1 and F2 on our L2 space is equal to the integral over the diagonal. Well, that's just one. So our kernel function is a function on G cross G. The diagonal is just G. And this is an integral over G of, of xx dx. And now, remembering what that thing is, the kernel, so that's an integral over G, but the kernel itself had an integral over G in it. So this thing is going to be two integrals over G. F1G, F2 X inverse G X. Well, our kernel had somehow, X inverse G Y, but now Y is equal to X. So we see that this thing is something very simple. It's better now somehow. It's just the conjugate of G by the group element X, or, well, conjugate by X inverse, maybe. Now, in this integral, if I like, I mean, we can use Houdini's theorem, everything converges just fine. We're in a compact situation, everything's continuous. So if I rewrite this, I can do the integral in the other order. And if I'm doing the integral over x first, then f1 of g is just a constant, so it comes out. So you can also write this, if you want, like this. So let's think about the general nature of this expression. We're integrating on the group G, the given function f1, against a new function on the group. The new function on the group is obtained from f2 in a very simple way. Namely, you take f2, and then you just make it into a class function. You make it into a function that's a conjugation invariant by integrating over conjugacy classes. So this is a new function on the group, which is, again, I mean, this function, if we look at this function here, g, goes to this integral. Because we're in this happy situation of having a compact group, there's no difficulty in doing this. And this function is, again, of the same sort. I mean, that's another continuous function on the group, this function belongs, again, to continuous functions on the group. So in other words, you take your function f2 that you start it with, that's a continuous function on the group, but then you make a conjugation invariant, and then you're just integrating that new thing against f1. That's all this thing is. But now we can carry this, this equal sign comes down from the continuation of that calculation. If we like, we can write this in yet a further form, because what we're doing is we're integrating this function f1 against a new function which is a class function. And so that integral can be expressed as an integral of, in this integral here, we can replace both f1 and f2 by this kind of function. So this thing here, why don't I call this thing f2 twiddle of g. All right, so that this function that it was occurring here, I'm now just giving it the name, f2 twiddle of g. In other words, f2 twiddle is the function you get from f2 by making a conjugation invariant. But now we can just make it symmetrical, because we're integrating f1 against a class function, you can do, again, a kind of Fumini thing, and we can replace this guy by the one that's averaged, as well as this one. So in some ways, this is nicer because it's more symmetrical. Okay, so what what this thing means is we are we take both functions, f1 and f2, and we replace them by new functions which are just given by averaging over conjugacy classes. Since our measure has total measure 1, integrating over it's an average. And so we're replacing these functions by the new functions that are average values over conjugacy classes, and then you just take the scalar product. Let me simply erase the 2 for any f. This is a general definition, all right? For a continuous function f, we will simply define f twiddle in that way. So apply it to both f1 and f2. Yeah. No, thanks. Sorry, I should have said that. Now, on the other hand, sorry? How does the trace equal that thing at the end? You mean the last step? Okay. That's actually an excellent question. How do you actually justify that? All right. So here's the so why? Okay, so I'm claiming that this one's equal to, or I guess I can point to the equals. So why? Let me do just give a very naive way. Because this, remember, this is a Haar measure, so I can change variables. And actually, I should be pointing to this dx here. So in this dx, I can change variables, and I can put in a conjugation. All right, change of variables, whatever you want to call it, replace x in inner integral by, now I want it to move by yx. Okay, for the moment, y is some fixed element in g. Okay, and I'm in this inner integral right here, I'm going to replace everywhere x by y times x. I can do that because it's a Haar measure, it's invariant. So I'll still get, this won't change, but I'll suddenly have a y in here and a y inverse there. But now consider the outer integral. The outer integral, again, I can, I'm integrating over all g's. And our Haar measure is a conjugation invariant measure. So I can do a change of variables in G in which I replace it. I want to change this back to G. So to change this back to G, I'd better replace everywhere G by Y, G, Y inverse, everywhere. Okay, so the next step is then replace, G by Y, G, Y inverse in second integral, in the outer integral. Oops. What do we get at that point? We get that same thing. So now here, I think you need to grant me that I can write an equals here, because I've proved it, by making these changes of variables. What's the net outcome after doing both changes of variable? G, F1, Y, G, Y inverse. And then this part is just what it was before. And we're calling that thing F twiddle G. Okay, so do you agree with that I have not cheated here? Unless I made some mistake. I mean, something like this is correct. Of course, any given thing I write actually may be wrong, because I might just slip up. This equality is true for every value of y. So this equality is for all y. In other words, that expression is actually independent of y. So it's now legitimate to integrate that constant expression over g, and it won't change the value. So then this thing is equal to its integral over g, right? Our Haar measure gives total measure 1, so just integrate the whole thing over g, you just get that same number back again. But when you integrate, I mean, I'm talking about integrating over all y's. That's the thing that's varying now. We have this equality for each that specific value of y. Now integrate over y. And then you get the thing I said. Okay, then you get this. Okay, so I tried to sweep some stuff under the rug, but You guys didn't let me. That's actually excellent. I'm happy to do that. Now, as I was starting to say, on the other hand, now we can get back to the on the other hand, the Peter Weyl theorem tells us what L2G looks like. I'm just going to appeal to that. L2 of G equals, as a G cross G module, and this is Peter Weyl, it's a direct sum in the sense of Hilbert spaces, so I'll put a hat over it to mean that I'm not taking the algebraic sum, but some completed version of it. The index set for the direct sum will be irreducible representations of the group G on finite dimensional complex vector spaces V. All right, so V is a finite dimensional C vector space. Pi is an irreducible representation of G on V. Okay, so in other words, pi is a homomorphism from G to all the invertible linear maps. GLCV is all the invertible linear transformations from V to itself. Pi is a homomorphism like that, and it's continuous. Continuous is a map from that topological group to that other topological group. I didn't finish writing what the thing is a direct sum of. I need to write down something which is a G cross G module. There's two ways to do it. Both of them are useful. I mean, they're two equivalent ways. One way is to write V tensored with the contour gradient. All right, so V star, pi star V star is the contour gradient representation, which means, in other words, V star is just a dual vector space. And pi star is pi star of G is G transpose. If you have, pi of G induces something on the dual vector spaces, the transpose, take the inverse of that to get a left module. That's completely unreadable. That's one way. We can think about it as being V tensor V star, the tensor product being over C. As usual, when you have two representations, you can form their tensor product, and that'll be another representation using a diagonal sort of action. But of course, V tensor V star can also be thought of. Maybe I'll just write it here, just that part. This is Hom. It's just Hom from V to itself. So it's endomorphisms of that complex vector space. In other words, it's just matrices of size equal to the dimension. And in this point of view, you also see the G action is especially clear here. Oh, yeah, so of course this equality is actually, I said something slightly misleading maybe. Normally what you do when you have two representations is you form their tensor product and think of that as a representation of just the one copy of the group. But in a sense what's really going on is when you have two representations of the group, their tensor product over C is actually a representation of the product group. And then what you usually do is just embed the group into the product with itself in the diagonal way to get a representation of G. But here I'm not doing that. I'm actually thinking about this V here is a representation of G, and then this V star I'm thinking about as a representation of that second factor of G. So you have to keep track of what's going on here. We also have a G cross G action on the endomorphism, which is equally easy to see, because an endomorphism is just a map from V to V, and you can either pre-compose or post-compose with something linear, and, well, to get one of these actions, you pre-compose with one of the pi G, so you can either, I'm a little bit afraid. Okay, let me not try to sort this out. Here I think it's, I will try to sort it out. So I think that there's a 75% chance that it's pi of G where I said it was and pi of G inverse in the other place. Anyway, you can tell by tracking through, the thing that's for sure right is that here, you know, G is acting the usual way, just like by pi, and here it's acting by pi star, the first factor. So this is sort of pi of G1, pi star of G2. And that means that our trace, which way, I think I'm going to, it's sort of hard to say which way you should write it. Maybe I'll take that last version. So therefore, and this is the trace formula that I was referring to. Therefore, we get the trace formula. Maybe I'll use this last version. The trace of a tensor product of two linear transformations is just the product of the traces. All right, and therefore our final conclusion as far as this formula goes is that there it is, and well, depending on what's convenient, you can take the left side to be one of these other versions as well, but that's the most symmetrical one. I also want to go further with this, I want to go further with this by thinking in terms of the characters of these representations, pi and, well, pi star, or, let's focus on pi. So the representation pi has a character, which I will denote by, let's make this a definition. I will write theta sub pi for the character of pi by definition. This is the function whose value at the group element G is the trace of pi of G. Because our representation is finite dimensional, we have no trouble understanding what we mean by the trace of that linear transformation. So the trace is a function of G. Right? This trace is, well, it's a continuous function on G because our representation is continuous. And I don't know how you want to think about it. It's a continuous and therefore L2 function on G. And then there's a smeared out version of that in which we also consider these traces like we've got. I will, since we've got both F1 and F2 and pi star or whatever, let me explain it in terms of pi and F, kind of as a general thing. So the trace of pi of F, oh, I didn't define, sorry, that's one thing I should do first. Let me do it up here. I don't want to explain the trace part. Let me explain what I mean by pi of F1. That is, yeah, I forgot to do that. It's just, well, this has to be the smeared out version of the group action of the first one, the one coming from the left factor. And the smeared out version of that is, so pi of F1, you can write it this way, it's just, well, maybe I should write the function first. But let me erase the one and just do it as a general thing. So pi of f is a continuous function. Pi of f is integral of f of g, pi of g, dg. Each pi of g, if you choose a basis in your vector space, is just a matrix. And the matrix is a function of g. And when you integrate it, it just means integrate each matrix entry. Okay, so the definition of integrating a matrix-valued function is just a special case of integrating a vector-valued function, and you integrate a vector-valued function by integrating every component of it. For matrices, the components of the matrix entries. All right, so that it has to be understood in that sense. And the thing I wanted to say here, all right, so now we have, again, f is some continuous function. We see by just applying trace everywhere what happens. So let's take this thing, which this is the definition here. But if I take that definition and apply the trace to both sides, I'll get trace of pi f, which is what I care about. And then here the trace just moves in and we get the trace of pi of g. But that's the character, that's theta of g. So certainly this thing is equal to the integral over g. The f of g didn't get changed by that. Theta pi of g, dg. Okay, so say if we were, this G is just some compact group. But suppose we were on a Lie group, so made sense to talk about differentiating things, and it made sense to talk about smooth functions and distributions. Then we would say that this distribution, which we had defined, this left side is a distribution. It's something which involves a test function f. This distribution is actually given by integration of our test function against some nice function, the character. All right, so in a context when it makes sense to utter the word distribution, then this distribution we have on the left side is actually a function. It's just represented by that character, theta pi. Okay, so now I want to get a consequence of this of our trace formula, which I'll formulate as a claim here just in a second. But this consequence involves another space of functions. And for this, we need just a bit more from the Peter Weil stuff. In our Peter Weil theorem, we were working with L2 of G, which is a Hilbert space, and writing as a Hilbert space, direct sum of these nice finite dimensional vector spaces, NCV. Well, inside of that Hilbert space direct sum, we have the more algebraic thing, which is just take the direct sum in the algebraic sense of those same NCVs. That sits inside the whole thing as a, well, let me write the thing again. Okay, but inside of here, I want to take the algebraic direct sum. This is also part of the Peter Weil story. Just algebraic. Same thing. That's going to correspond to something over here, namely what? All the functions that we get in this way by tracking back to here, they're going to be continuous. So they'll sit inside of, they will be inside the continuous functions, which are inside L2. But they're very special ones. I mean, think maybe of the case, which is the very simplest non-trivial compact group, namely the circle group. So suppose that G is the circle group, then there's one irreducible representation for each integer. But here we're taking an algebraic direct sum over each of those integers. So which functions on the circle are we going to get? We're going to get finite linear combinations of the irreducible characters. All right, so for every integer, you've got an irreducible character on the circle, which is just given by raising the thing to the nth power if n is that integer. And, or if you, I mean, you can think of them in terms of exponential functions or whatever, however you think about Fourier analysis on a circle, you have those basic characters that you do your Fourier analysis with. And here we would only be getting things that are finite sums of those characters. All right, but anyway, what's the answer? So they're very special, they're continuous functions, but very, very special ones. I'm just going to write a sub-zero for them. Okay, so inside of here we get the ones that we, you know, that we get by doing this procedure. But how do you characterize them in a way that doesn't go through the Peter Weil theorem? How do you just say it, you know, from in simple terms? These are the functions. These are those continuous functions. So this is f in C of G, such that. Such that that function generates a finite dimensional subrepresentation under either the left or right or simultaneous actions. It just doesn't matter. You get the same thing no matter what, how you interpret the words. Maybe for definiteness, I will say f and c of g such that the linear span of the things I get by taking translates. F G dot is finite dimensional. Okay, so we take the given function. This means translated on the left by G. That's a new continuous function. There's infinitely many group elements G, and so this is going to be an infinite set of functions. But we're interested in the ones where their linear span is finite dimensional. That makes them very, very special. And anyway, they're the ones that come up here. So they're like trigonometric polynomials in the classical case. And see, we would get, as a consequence, that the same conditions holds on the right. That can be. And so you can do it either way, or you can require both at the same time, and no matter how you do it, you get the same definition. Yeah. So we have that definition now. The next formula I'm going to write down is a consequence of our trace formula, but it only applies to these functions, or well, probably I mean, it does apply to these new special kinds of functions here. I'm not going to get involved in the analysis of it. Undoubtedly, it holds for even bigger function spaces. But for our purposes, that doesn't really matter. Before I make that statement, let me just make one remark. For these special continuous functions, so these are usually called G finite. The finite referring to the fact that this span is finite dimensional. That's where the word finite comes from. G finite means, you know, you operate on with G in all possible ways and you still get something finite dimensional. For F, which is for a continuous function f, which is g finite, when we look at our trace formula, we have these terms, trace pi of whatever the function is. With this hypothesis, the formula becomes of an algebraic nature. This thing, of course, really can be an infinite series. It typically is. It'll be absolutely convergent infinite series in general. But once we're in this situation, we have the trace pi f will be zero, usually, except for finitely many cases. Trace pi f will zero for all but finitely many pi. Namely, I mean, this f comes from, it's in this algebraic direct sum. So this function only involves finitely many irreducible representations. Anyway, that means when we start using a function like this, our formula becomes much more algebraic. We have finite sums rather than infinite series. But anyway, here's the next formula. So claim, this is a formula we get. One formula for each group element. So take a group element, and we'll get a formula for it. But the formula will involve only these, probably you can extend it to more general functions, but I'm just going to say it for these extremely nice G-finite continuous functions. This new formula goes like this. We simply take a function this given one, our continuous g-finite function, we take it and we get a complex number by simply averaging the values of that function over the conjugacy class of the specified element. We picked an element g, integrate over that conjugacy class, we get a number. And that number will be given by a seemingly an infinite series, but as I say, in this case, it boils down to a finite sum because all but finitely many are actually zero. But on the face of it, it's an infinite series over all our irreducible representations. So the index set is like in Peter Weil. And the first thing you find, remember we had this element G whose conjugacy class we're examining. We find here in the term index by pi the value of that character on that given element. But of course, so far this can't be the end because it doesn't involve f. The way that f enters in is by, the trace of pi actually star. Trace pi star, the contragradient on f. Where does this come from? Okay. we want to derive this from the trace formula, and I think that the one I want to use is this one here. We have three different versions of the left side of the trace formula, and let's use the one that's like this. I saved it because it's the one we want to use here. All right, so we're going to have, and I'm going to apply the trace formula to which functions? I'm going to take just an arbitrary test function f1, but for f2, I'm going to take the given one, f. Okay, so this is the trace, this is trace formula for f1, and where f2 we take to be the given function that we're trying to prove something about over here. And what happens when we do that? Well, I just copy this left, this version of the left-hand side. We have f1g, integral of g. Now f2 is just f, x inverse g, x, dx, dg, equal to. And now, when I, now I have to come over to here, and I want to expand this thing out. Trace of pi f1, we have this equation here, expressing it in terms of the integral of, it'll be f1 of g, theta pi of g. Because I'm, in this, the way this proof is going to go, f1 is just serving the role of a test function. In the end, we'll just delete it. So I want to have f1 appearing in the same way as being kind of a test function. Sorry. The first thing I was supposed to write was a sum over pi v's. I was writing, starting to write the contribution of a given v. That thing is, that's just trace of pi on f1. And now the other one, I'll just leave it alone. Trace of pi star on f2, but we took f2 to be f. Now, notice that because of this fact that we're dealing with a function f where this is really an algebraic situation, that means in essence this is a finite sum, and because it's a finite sum, it's legitimate to interchange the integral with the sum. Okay, so can switch integral and sum, because our sum is finite. And actually, then you sort of see what, I mean, if you can do this step, if you have a function f where you can do this step, then the formula is still going to work. So it's going to work for more functions f, but I've made it work for a really easy reason. Then we get integral over g, f1 of g. And now I want to just collect everything else, because I want to think about both sides as being integration of a test function, f1, against something, and then we're going to delete the test function. So over here, it's going to be sum over pi v, and just collect the remaining things. Okay, but we have this inequality for all test functions f1, any continuous function on g. And that means that the things that we're integrating against them. Sorry? Well, wait, what did I forget? Theta pi of g. Oh, yeah. Well, they're close together in the alphabet. How is one supposed to tell f from g? Thanks, that's much better. Now we have this equality for all test functions f1, just delete those. We get as our conclusion that the thing right here is equal to the thing right here. And if I haven't messed up anything, that's going to be what we were supposed to be proving. Seems to be right. All right, so we're done with the proof. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think so. Wait, take F1 to be the constant function 1? I don't know exactly, but I mean, I wouldn't see how to do it that way. We have to separate. Well, or I would say in a sense that we want F1 to be the delta function of the conjugacy class of G. Yeah, okay. Okay. All right. Let me now, well, I've got these things on the board. I want to plow ahead. I think I've got a few more minutes. So special case is, of course, the case G equals 1. That's a nice special case because then on the left side, we're just taking conjugates of the identity element. So the left side is just going to boil down to the function value at the identity. And we conclude that f of 1 is equal to, well, when we, again on the right side, there's a simplification because when we take the value of the character at the identity element, that's the trace of the identity element. The identity element acts by the identity. The trace is the dimension. So we get the dimension of pi. Times trace pi star f. Here we're summing over all pi's, and so if you like, you can delete this if you want. You have to just change, you have to replace what you mean by, you know, switch pi with pi star, but you're summing over all pi's, so you can do that. All right, so this is a version of Fourier inversion, expressing the value of f at 1 in terms of Fourier coefficients, I guess, whatever those things are, trace pi f. What else? I'm going to have to. I'm going to have to sort of shorten things a little here. Next time I'm going to I don't want to delete these last considerations. So next time I will discontinue. I'll continue something related to this, in which we will take this formula here and make this function f even more special. Okay, and we'll see. We'll see what happens when you take orbital integrals of matrix coefficients and compare those with these character values. So there's one little bit left over for next time.